Session number 12390, George Sakaguchi, Reel 1.
Sakaguchi, Reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all, George, something about your background, you know, where you were born and brought up, okay, and the sort of family you came from.
Okay. I was born in California, and my father was a farmer, I was born on a farm, raised on a farm, and when we left in 1942, we left the farm. And where I was born in California is a place called Hanford, which is a kind of geographical center of California. my father came to the United States in about 1890, in the late 1890s. I'm not right. I can get. I'm not sure the exact date. And he came to Alaska, and he got a job on a fishing cannery, and fishing industry. And eventually, he went into Canada. And there was an enterprising young Canadian lawyer who said for $25 he would give them papers to come to the United States. Well, it was illegal, but the people at the border, I guess they didn't know. He came to the United States, and I guess he did various jobs. I know he worked on a railroad. He worked in home as a kind of a houseboy. Then eventually, I don't know when my uncle came over, but he and my uncle back in the early 1920s were farming together. And then in late 1920s, my mother was sick, and she went in the hospital. She had tuberculosis, and she was in the hospital, and my uncle got a letter. They got a letter from my grandfather. Said one of them had to come back and take care of the farm in Japan. And so at that time, my uncle went back to Japan, and he took my two older sisters with him because my mother was in the hospital with the thought of bringing them back when she got well. Then I had another sister. She passed away 5 or 6 years. She was the youngest of the four of us, and my uncle said he would not take her because when my mother went into the hospital, my youngest sister was less than a year old, and my uncle said he wouldn't take her to Japan because too much of a burden. Then there was a Caucasian family who lived across the road, and my father asked them to take care of her, and he would pay her a little bit. Well, then while she was there, my mother passed away, and so that was during the Depression. And he went to these people and said he couldn't afford to pay them. But these people were so kind, they said, well, how are you going to raise a little, you know, year and a half or two-year-old girl and your son and earn a living? And so they said, well, we'll take care of her until such time that you can pay us or whatever. She stayed there she stayed with them to about the middle of 1944. They were very kind about that. But from that period on, my father and my father just farmed. And I know we moved around several places. And in the Depression years, it was pretty tough because he was just kind of a laborer. And he went wherever the work was. And up until about, I guess the mid-30s, until about the mid-30s, it was pretty tough, you know, Depression. Then he made contact with somebody, and he made a deal with some farmer, and he had kind of like sharecrop. And we lived there until we had to leave in 1942.
Do you remember Pearl Harbor, George?
Yes.
Could you tell me about that, where you
well,
were?
Well, the only thing, well, I was in California, and we had heard that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor, and I guess that we're kind of too young to really make a big impact, but I know that the older people around there were, they kept saying that they were going to come over and attack the United States and land in United States soil and all sorts of things like that. But right after Pearl Harbor, within a month, all people of Japanese ancestry were restricted. In other words, there was a curfew from 6 at night till 6 in the morning, and you couldn't be more than 10 miles from home. And then there were rumors came out that they were going to evacuate all the people of Japanese ancestry off the west coast of the United States, like Washington, Oregon, and California. So they gave us an opportunity to move inland. Okay? And the first exclusion zone was 10 miles from the coast. Okay? So they kept moving this line east, and then eventually they just said all of California, states of California, Oregon, and western two-thirds of Washington, state of Washington. But it was kind of odd that only, I don't know how many people, they moved out of Hawaii, but all people of Japanese ancestry were not moved from Hawaiian Islands, because the people of Japanese ancestry were the largest ethnic group in Hawaii at that time. And I know that there were people of Japanese ancestry that were moved to California during the internment, but how they selected who goes and who didn't go, I never did know.
How did that affect you, once the United States was at war with Japan? Mm-hmm. Can you remember how you felt about it? Because after all, your relatives would have been in Japan, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Well, I was still in high school, just starting high, some of the remarks were made by the Caucasian population. There was, we trust you, but we don't know about your father and other people they didn't know. Prior to World War II, and in California, there's a tremendous amount of discrimination against Asians. Okay, they had Asian land laws, but also there were a lot of places that restricted us from going in. There were schools in California that you couldn't go to because, just like, that happened to the blacks, I guess, until the early 50s. but we were always afraid that some of the hot-headed whites would come over. But I never encountered any such incident like that. But you were always under surveillance, we also had a good friend in my high school class who was a Chinese American, and he had a big sign on his car that said, "I am Chinese American." He'd say, "Well, if you want to go some," so he used to come over and pick me up at night, of course, the white folks didn't know Chinese from Japanese. But the police in this small town that I grew up were living at the time of Pearl Harbor. They knew who I was, but they didn't bother me. They just said, "We're gonna look the other way. But if you get caught, we're gonna ignore that. We're gonna tell them you were warned, and you're gonna have to suffer the consequences." But in this town, actually, where I went to high school, so I knew most of the people I knew, so, and I was very discreet in where I went, but I didn't go out just once in a while, go out at nighttime, because...
How did it affect your father and his work?
Well, see, my father, of course, being a widower, he'd go work in the morning, and he would. We stayed on the one farm. He didn't go anyplace, essentially, except to buy groceries or something like that. But in those days, we were poor, so we didn't go. 30 miles, 20, 30 miles was a long ways for us to travel, and so the community was very small. And you got to realize that we didn't get assimilated into the white community. And when I was growing up, I went to Japanese school, and they had Buddhist churches. And so these were the, you know, the social and religious centers for the Japanese community. And so I think part of what the thing was that because we didn't get assimilated into, and they wouldn't let us assimilate, I guess, that they didn't know us. And of course, in those days, there wasn't this instant communications and all this hysteria. And then there were groups out in California like the Golden Sons, the Sons of the Golden West and the Grange and Farm Bureau, who were anxious to get us out. There's a book written by Alan Boswell about this, and at the beginning of every chapter, he's got a little, I don't know, he's taken some from Kipling and some, but I can remember when it said, the miners came in 1849 when they discovered gold. It said, the miners came in 49, the horse came in 51, and 2 years later, 2 years later, the Sons of the Golden West were born, or something like that. But anyway, so you know, I think that the white population were very suspicious of it. They really didn't know. In our community, there were a lot of people of Portuguese ancestry, okay, and they were not at the same level as white Anglo-Saxons or. So there was this pecking order, and so those people, they just, I think they sympathized with us more. But from the time in Pearl Harbor in 1941 to when we had to leave in May 1942, I didn't incarnate. Nobody come up and call me a Jap or anything like that. So, and not about 10 miles from our home, they were building the Army Air Corps training base, and there was a lot of influx of a lot of outsiders to work there, but most of us of Japanese ancestors, we knew better than to go to places where they assemble,
Yes, it's very interesting, you know, this.
But I think, see, you got, you know, in up until 1952 or 53, when they passed the McCarran-Walters Act, no Asian immigrant could become an American citizen. Okay, so that someone who immigrated from Asia could see that their counterpart from Europe, who could become citizens. So I think that they realize that they never were going to be first-class citizens, okay? And that's what my father used to say. I don't care if you're born in the United States and got all the citizenships as guaranteed by the Constitution because you're native-born, but you're never going to be accepted totally. And discrimination was pretty evident. And I think our parents knew that, and they made sure that they did. They didn't make any waves as, because of the and the fact that they couldn't become American citizens for our parents, I think they thought that they did something wrong, and that's why, because that was part of the internment. But you got to realize in 1942, in that era, okay. The first generation of those of us born over here, the oldest one was about 22, 23, mid-20s, and we had no voice, we had no power, okay? So that, and we were such a small group, especially on the continental United States, they didn't have to pay attention to us. So that, and also, having done some reading on it, So President Roosevelt wanted to go to war with somebody. And I can still remember when he went to meet with Churchill at Dumbarton Oaks, and one of the news persons says, well, one of the, you know, Roosevelt was so unhappy because Churchill didn't ask him to help England, the Allies, in the war. And I think that Churchill and Stalin and Mussolini and Adolf Hitler and Roosevelt and Tojo, I mean, I think they were kind of a group that, you know, they had worked up their people to say, we got to build up the army and everything. And the payoff, they had to go to war. Well, yeah, I think that Hitler's a very classically, you know, he got all those kids and when he got to the point, some point, he had to go to war with somebody, or, right?
And well, were you worried, you know, I wondered though, you know, the fact that America, the country you were living in, mm-hmm. was at war with Japan, where your relatives were. How did you feel about that? Was it a difficult thing for you to cope with?
Well, somehow I think we were convinced that Japan wasn't going to come over here. They couldn't afford to come. They didn't have the wherewithal to get over here to carry on a war 5,000 miles away. Was almost impossible logistically. We were convinced that they were going to come over. We were more concerned about what the white folks in California were going to do to us than that. There were articles in the newspaper and stuff that the war, they kept saying, even in the late 30s, that war within Japan is inevitable. And I think Japan, the Japanese government, felt that, as was explained to me by somebody who worked for the Japanese government, and he was in a Japanese army back prior to World War II and all that, you know, with all this. And they were very nationalistic, and they said that he said, well, the people who ran Japan in those days felt that, well, England went out beginning, and, you know, the sun never set on the British flag, and you know, and all these other countries had developed colonies all over the world. And they said it was our turn. And so I think that was part of their thinking because, well, the way Japan went into Manchuria and took over Manchuria. And they were aware the French were in southeast of England owned practically China. So they thought, well, if they can do it, we can do it too. In ad libbing here, I'm convinced that, you know, in the whole world there's a pecking order. Okay, if you're white, you're on top, and then just on down. And I can remember the big argument about the number of battleships England, United States, and Japan could have, 5, 5, and 3 or something like that. And so, in those days, my father was really interested in these things, and he read a lot, and he told me, and I wasn't interested, but he said. And he said, you know, you're never going to be a first-class citizen. And he said that you've got to accept it if you want to get along in this world. And our parents accepted. They said, well, we're only going to get entitled to certain things. And if it goes against us, that's, you know. And also, the Japanese people, our parents, made sure that we didn't, their peers and their children, never did anything to bring focus or bring anything disgrace are because they knew that the actions of one or two people of Japanese ancestry, you know, if you meet a white person if I was a good guy and you knew me, you said, well, I know George, he's Japanese, he's a heck of a nice guy, so all Japanese, but conversely, if I'm bad, you know, that's the way it goes. So I think they realize that. The other thing is, when I was growing up, and all of us, define some words here. Our parents were considered Issei's, okay, because they were the first generation of Japanese people to come over here. Okay, We were Nisei'd because we're the second generation, but we're all born. Then our children, are, you know, they call them Sansei, Jonseis, and because it's Ichini, Sanshi, Go. But anyway, it's down to about fifth or sixth generation here in the continental United States. Now, in Hawaii, about 5 years ago, they celebrated the first 100 years since the first person of Japanese ancestry came to Hawaii. So, seventh and eighth generation is nothing unusual. In fact, one time I went to a convention in Hawaii, and and our organization said, we've got to get the third and fourth generation Japanese active into our organization. And this guy, about 80 years old, said, well, I'm third generation. You know, he just did it as a funny, but...
But I think the when we were at home, or when I, or at least most of us, when we were home, when we were in the house, we were in Japan because we spoke Japanese, we ate Japanese totally, food totally, but when we went outside the door, we went out in the United States. And some years ago, about 10, 12 years ago, Newsweek wrote us, the Japanese Americans, up as one of the ones who went from here to there, and no other ethnic group has gone up as fast as. But as I said the other day, I was in Los Angeles, and the Japanese American History Museum people asked me to do oral history because I was in the Midwest, as opposed to those on most of those who got out of the internment camps after World War II in 1940, they went back to California, where there's a few of us stayed here from. So they just wanted to, they talked to me about what I thought about, why I didn't go back, and why, what is the difference between being in California and in the Midwest. And I said that, well, part of the conversation was talking about how we came from parents who could not read or write English or understand English that well, and we have accomplished so much. And I think that we are really a proud group because I think our parents, and I don't know how, my father was a son of a poor farmer in Japan, and came over here without anything. And my mother was the same. Well, in fact, in 1918, 19, some period in there, he went back and married my mother and came back. But we get together and we often wonder what our parents did for us or did to us or how they made us such high achievers. And especially when we look around today and look at the new immigrants that are coming into the United States from Asia.
What do you come up with? You know, what is the answer? Is it the sort of closeness of the family that you were describing and the discipline?
Well, I don't think we were disciplined any more than anybody else. And the other thing, just to make it a little bit more clear, my wife is Caucasian. And I live over here, not more than 10 minutes west of here. I mean, south of here. And I have one daughter. And one of the things that she said when she was growing up, she said, "Dad, you don't love me." I said, "Why?" She goes to her, with her white girlfriend, they go to their house and the mother and father house. And we never, our parents, Japanese people don't hug or they don't say that, they don't say, "I love you." And their mentality, the men's mentality, is, you know, my wife and I, because she's Caucasian and I'm not. We get into some discussion about some heated discussions about and my mentality is like, listen, honey, I married you. That, you know, that proves that I love you. And with my daughter, whatever she wanted, we gave her material things. And I guess with the Asian or the Japanese mindset is, that's what all we're supposed to do, you know, because in Japan, men are very chauvinistic, and that's the way it's inbred into the women that, you know, whatever your husband, because we were talking
when I was in California, I stayed with a family that the man is, works for a Japanese company. He's born and raised in Japan. He was sent over here. You know, it's the company first and his family second. His wife happened to be a Chinese girl born in the United States. And she said, George, I just don't understand that. That company is more important to him than I am. And I said, well, Sandy, I said, that's the way the Japanese are. And you got to accept it. But she says, anything I want to do. He never says no. So I guess he figures that in some way they reciprocate.
Could I ask you now about internment?
Okay.
You know, and if you could describe the sort of stages of what happened to you, George.
Well, right after Pearl Harbor, as I said, within a month after, they put a curfew on and we couldn't go. We couldn't go any place more than 10 miles from home. And I, if you had an emergency or something, you could get permission from the provost marshal or somebody. But then I think about in February 1942, President Roosevelt put out Executive Order 9066, which said all people of Japanese ancestry would be excluded from the West Coast. And that's what started the removal of people of Japanese ancestry off the West Coast. Now, for those who wanted to move, they could move. But the states of Colorado, and there were a lot of them that went to Colorado and Utah, and the governor said you couldn't. They didn't want them in there, but. The idea is we're American citizens, we can live anywhere I want, but there was a lot of pressure. But there were Japanese people, Japanese ancestry, that lived in Utah and Colorado, and they had migrated back a long time ago. So those who wanted to move, and I know that because when they came out with this 10-mile exclusion from the coast, there were a lot of moved into inland, and they were moved into our community with the hope that they wouldn't have to move. But then when government executive order said everybody had to go then. So in May of 1942, we had to go to a place called an assembly center, which was, they put us in there until they built the camps inland. Now, the first camps were built in Arizona and down in the deserts of Arizona. So those who lived east of a highway that kind of cuts California from north to south, those people east of that went almost directly to the camp, where the rest of us, we went into these assembly centers. And there were 10 camps all over the United States, two in Arkansas, and one in Idaho and Utah and Wyoming and California had one, I think, and then Arizona had three or four. But when we went to these assembly centers, it was just nothing, tar paper barracks. And eventually the Army used them as training centers for the military. But they were just tar paper shack with dirt floors and community mess halls and community toilet facilities. And because we were on the West Coast, they had military guarding the place, and just almost like a kind of a minimum security prison. But one of the things that's been written since then by historians is they've never had any problem. That they never try to break out or anything like that. In fact, then in November of 1942, we were moved to Arkansas. Okay, and there are two camps in the southeast part of Arkansas. And these were of the same configuration, but were a little bit, a lot more substantial. And they had the same, I think there were 12 barracks in each each block, and there was then the mess all north. But they had divisions in them, so different size rooms, and so he had a little bit more privacy, but not much more. And there in Arkansas, I can remember, there was only a fence that ran across the front, and there was the only guard post was right in, at the gate. Outside of that, the back was wide open. You could walk out. But, you know, if we walked out of the camp, it was obvious who we were, so they never had. But...
Did you live with your father? Mm-hmm. Were you able to have a family unit?
Yes. But, see, they had six rooms in each barrack, and each end, two were the same size. Well, there were two the same size, but there were, out of the six, they were paired like same size. So we had two rooms, two little rooms, but all I had was...